an insurrection against Octavian in Italy itself. Remember, Mark Antony's in the east. That's really his area of interest. But here we have Mark Antony's brother and wife fomenting unrest against Octavian in Italy. It's usually called the Perusine War or the Affair of Perusia because it ultimately centered around this town in Etruria called Perusia. The big question that we'd like to have answered is, to what degree was Mark Antony himself involved in the actions of his brother and his wife in Italy? Was Mark Antony himself actively urging them to try to undermine Octavian's position? Or was Lucius and was Fulvia acting on the perceived tensions between Antony and Octavian? Unfortunately, we can't answer that, and the matter remains moot. Whatever the case, Lucius Antonius and Fulvia fomented sufficient unrest against Octavian in Italy that they raised a force against him and caused a war in Italy, which ran into 40 BC. It began at the end of 41 and ran into 40 BC. This war, as I say, is called the Perusine War because Fulvia and Lucius Antonius were effectively besieged by Octavian in this town of Perusia. Eventually, they were starved out of the town. Antonius and Fulvia were spared, but the councillors of the town of Perusia were rather capriciously and inexcusably executed by Octavian, further making him unpopular in Italy at this time. Mark Antony, for his part, began to move west. With his brother and his wife being attacked by Octavian, hostilities breaking out between the camps of Octavian and the camps of Antony draws Antony west. He's coming to Italy with substantial forces, and it looks like there's going to be a full-scale civil war between Antony and Octavian late in 40 BC. Fortunately for everyone concerned, negotiations took place instead. There was tense standoff, but intermediaries effectively brought the men together, and in 40 BC we have the so-called Pact of Brundisium, a new agreement between Antony and Octavian. The agreement effectively reconfirms the situation as it stood in 40 BC. Octavian was to have control now of all of the western provinces, Antony of all of the eastern provinces, and Lepidus was to be shunted away in Africa, sidelined, effectively pushed into the rear. Once they split apart, once they left from the Pact of Brundisium, Antony once again went east and Octavian went west. Fulvia died shortly afterwards, rather fortuitously, for all concerned, and the relationship between Antony and Octavian was cemented with a marital alliance. Antony married Octavian's sister, who was called Octavia. For the following 4 years or so, the situation then was that Mark Antony was concerned with his affairs in the east and his affair with Cleopatra. He used Alexandria, the capital of the Egyptian Ptolemaic kingdom, as his base of operations and spent a lot of time with Cleopatra, but also on campaign against the Parthians. We've already seen the Parthians in the context of Marcus Crassus' campaign against them in the 50s. Caesar had planned a great campaign against them before he was murdered. Antony inherited this idea and campaigned rather ineffectually against them for the next, well, more than 4 years, but certainly he was still doing so up to 36 BC. He had some successes, but nothing really decisive. In the west, Octavian remains in control of Italy. He's still not terribly popular and is made rather less popular by a very interesting situation that requires us to examine another rather interesting figure in our story we haven't mentioned yet, a man called Sextus Pompeius. Sextus Pompeius was the youngest son of Pompey the Great, Caesar's great rival. And it's a good illustration of the sort of disorder, anarchy, that we're dealing with in this period, that this man is still around, a leftover, basically, from the campaigns between Caesar and Pompey of the 40s. He's still around, causing trouble in the 30s BC. Sextus had been there in Spain at the campaign of Munda, when Caesar had finally defeated the Pompeian forces and established himself as the head of the Roman world. But he had escaped, And fleeing with a bunch of ships, he basically lived as a pirate for the next few years. Caesar tried to send various troops against him, and he evaded capture and succeeded in surviving almost as a pirate. Suddenly, Caesar was murdered. Sextus Pompeius found himself rehabilitated. He was now on the right side of things again, and the Senate actually assigned him a naval command to, I suppose, to ensure that his fleet would stay loyal to the state. But then, the triumvirate appeared, the second triumvirate. Sextus was once more out in the cold. He's shifting in his positions with regard to the central state. He essentially seized Sicily for himself and created something of a minor kingdom for himself in Sicily, a naval power, greatly enhanced, and his numbers greatly enhanced by the dispossessed of Italy, who were left out of land by the activities of Octavian in settling veterans, and those who had succeeded in escaping from the Battle of Philippi and the defeat of Brutus and Cassius. So there are enough people around to give Sextus Pompeius a very significant power in the West. This was to be Octavian's greatest bane for the first part of his control of the Western provinces up to 36 BC. For a while, Sextus and Octavian had to treat with each other. We hear, for instance, that they met, Octavian, Antony, and Sextus Pompeius met in 39 BC in a really interesting situation. Sextus Pompeius refused to come ashore. He would not trust Antony and Octavian not to kill him or to arrest him. So they set up platforms on the sea, one close to the shore and one further out to sea. And then Octavian and Antony sat on the platform nearest the shore, and Pompeius and his fleet came to the one further out to sea, and they shouted at each other and negotiated that way in 39 BC. Well, that arrangement quickly fell apart, and outright war broke out between Sextus and Octavian in 38 and continued on into 37. Octavian was not doing well in this campaign, so another meeting with Antony was scheduled for late in the year of 37 BC. This took place at Tarentum and is sometimes called the Pact of Tarentum. The triumvirate, which had lapsed in 38 BC, but no one had paid any attention to that fact, it was rather inconvenient, was renewed retroactively. Various forces were swapped. Octavian took some ships from Antony, and he gave him some troops for his campaigns against the Parthians. And everyone seemed, once again, to be on good terms with each other. Octavian, however, desperately needed to crush the power of Sextus Pompeius. Sextus was threatening the grain supply of Rome. Nothing would get the mob at Rome grumbling about the current governance of the state than the fact that they weren't getting fed. So Octavian desperately needed to put an end to the power of Sextus Pompeius. With the new ships given to him by Antony after the Pact of Tarentum in 37 BC, he reopened his campaign, drawing on Lepidus from Africa, bringing him over on land to attack Sicily by land, while Octavian and his right-hand man, we haven't mentioned him yet, but we should do now, a man called Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa. Agrippa, who was a friend and contemporary of Octavian's and was there right from the start from his career, was a very able general and naval commander. Between them, between Lepidus on land and Agrippa on sea, they outmaneuvered and defeated Sextus Pompeius in 36 BC. As a postscript, I'll tell you that Pompeius fled eastward, was eventually captured by Antony and executed the following year in 35. A very interesting guy, and really some more study needs to be done of this guy, because he's a very interesting figure for the late Republic. A good illustration of the levels of disorder that we've reached in the Roman Revolution in the 40s and 30s BC. So in 36 BC then, Octavian has restored order in the West. He has defeated the threat of Sextus Pompeius. He is now firmly in command of the situation in the West. But one last issue had to be dealt with. Lepidus had been sidelined now for the best part of 5 years in his relationship in the triumvirate. Finding himself in Sicily, in command of 22 legions, he seemed to have had something of a rush of blood to the head and tried to challenge Octavian's position in the West. Lepidus's army responded by deserting en masse to Octavian. He was left standing alone and humiliated. In response to his attempted challenge of Octavian's position, he was stripped of his triumviral powers. But surprisingly, he wasn't executed He was instead put under house arrest in a small seaside town south and west of Rome, where he lived out the rest of his days till 12 BC. Something of a curiosity. But the point is that in 36 BC, not only has Sextus Pompeius been defeated and Octavian is now well ensconced in control of the West, but the third triumvir, Lepidus, is now out of the picture. What we're left with then, at the end of the year, is Antony in the East and Octavian in the West. There's going to have to be a showdown. There's going to have to be a face-off. And indeed, that showdown and face-off will be the subject of our next lecture.
Lecture 31, Octavian Emerges Supreme.
Welcome to the History of Ancient Rome and Lecture 31 in our series. Today I want to bring the narrative section of the course to a close by examining the last phase of the Roman Revolution, which we have been studying since the tribunate of Tiberius Gracchus in 133 BC. Which got the revolution off to a start. I want to today examine the events of the years 36 through 31 BC, which saw the final breakdown of relations between Antony and Octavian, which saw the reinvention by Octavian of his political image in quite a remarkable way, eventually saw a conflict between Octavian and Antony, which turned out to be somewhat anticlimactic, but no less important for that, the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, that was to leave Octavian as the sole master of the Roman world. It was in the wake of this victory in 31 BC that Octavian was to create a whole new system of government known as the Principate and usher in a new era of Roman history, often called the Imperial period or the Empire. Octavian himself changed his name eventually to Augustus. That's how he's known to us. To most of the people who were aware of Roman history, would recognize Augustus as the first emperor of Rome. This then is our subject for today. In our last lecture, we left Octavian in control of the western half of the empire. He had effectively defeated Sextus Pompeius, at least his general Agrippa had done so, in a naval battle. And he had also outmaneuvered Lepidus, who had now been ousted from the triumvirate to live out his days in relative obscurity in a seaside villa near Rome. What's noticeable about the events of 36, what's so important about them, is that they gave Octavian thought for a new way of portraying himself, for a new political image, and he began to recast himself in quite a dramatic way in 36 and in the years following that. Up to now, Octavian has been really an out-and-out revolutionary. He has come to prominence by virtue of his adoption by Caesar, the dictator. He's raised legions. He's occupied the city of Rome by force. He's extracted the consulship from the people. And he has become a triumvir for reorganizing the state through force and violence. He's instituted proscriptions. He's settled veterans all around Italy through massive land confiscations. He's really has been relying almost entirely for his support so far in his career on his military backing. It seems that the large body of popular support that came behind Octavian, that gathered behind him in his conflict with Sextus Pompeius, who was after all threatening the grain supply of Rome, gave him thought to maybe expand the basis of his support, change somewhat the nature of his political image. For instance, following the Battle of Naulochus, the defeat of Sextus Pompeius in September of 36 BC. The Senate, formerly not really the best supporters or fans of Octavian, were so relieved that the threat of Pompeius had been removed that they voted him a variety of honors, statues in the city, public thanks, a victory arch, a house to be erected at public expense, the anniversary of the Battle of Naulochus to be a public holiday every year. We also hear that he was given a special position as sacrosanct individual. It meant that his person was inviolate, couldn't be harmed, he couldn't be arrested or manhandled or attacked in any way. These are special honours conveyed upon Octavian. After Lepidus had been pushed out of the triumvirate entirely, the Senate also voted him the position of Pontifex Maximus. Lepidus, the disgraced triumvir, was the Pontifex Maximus. He was the incumbent. This, by tradition, was the chief priesthood of Rome and was held for life. Now, with Lepidus ousted, the Senate seemed to have wished to get on Octavian's good side, and they voted him the position of chief priest of Rome, an extremely prestigious post. And one of our first signs that Octavian is changing, and certainly a signal that he's different from Caesar, who never refused an honour that was voted to him, Octavian refused to receive the chief priesthood of the city and of the state. He argued that it would have been against tradition and precedent for a chief priest of Rome to be stripped of that power and for it to be passed on to someone else. He would wait until Lepidus died, naturally, before assuming that power, and he had to wait all the way to 12 BC for that to happen. The point, though, is that early on, in 36 BC, Octavian is refusing a power, or at least a honour that's been given to him, and he's doing so on the claim that it would be against tradition. This is not really, these aren't the words of the out-and-out revolutionary. What's starting to happen now, and will escalate over the next 5 years, is that Octavian recasts himself now as the defender of traditional Roman values of the West. And he does so, first and foremost, by contrasting himself with Antony in the East. Remember, Antony is based predominantly in Alexandria. He's living with a foreign queen, Cleopatra VII, the Ptolemaic dynast of Egypt. And Octavian embarks upon, sometime around this period, maybe slightly later, but he embarks upon a propaganda war against Antony, in which he himself, as Octavian, recasts himself as the defender of Western, traditional Western Roman values against a man who has, to all intents and purposes, gone native and has changed his allegiance from Rome to a foreign despot, an Eastern despot. We get something of a hint of Octavian's propaganda. There must have been anti-Octavian, pro-Antony propaganda floating around as well, but we don't get an awful lot of that. It hasn't survived, since Antony, after all, was the loser in the conflict, ultimately. But we get clear indication of the sorts of accusations that were flying around from a passage in the historian Cassius Dio, who was writing far later than this period. He's writing in the late 2nd and early 3rd centuries AD, but wrote a history of Rome in 80 books, and is in fact one of our only continuous sources for the career of Augustus, or slash Octavian. But he contains in his book this passage, which must clearly be derived from the sort of anti-Antony propaganda that Octavian was putting out. There are several noticeable features of the passage that I'll come back to when I've read it. But here's what Dio writes. He says, "For she being of course Cleopatra, for she had enslaved him so absolutely that she persuaded him to act as gymnasiarch to the Alexandrians. And she was called queen and mistress by him, had Roman soldiers in her bodyguard, and all of these inscribed her name upon their shields. She used to frequent the marketplace with him, joined him in the management of festivals and in the hearing of lawsuits, and rode with him even in the cities, or else was carried in a chair while Antony accompanied her on foot along with her eunuchs. He also termed his headquarters the palace, sometimes wore an oriental dagger at his belt, dressed in a manner not in accordance with the customs of his native land, and let himself be seen, even in public, upon a gilded couch or a chair of that kind. He posed with her for portrait paintings and statues, he representing Osiris or Dionysus, and she Selene or Isis. This, more than all else, made him seem to have been bewitched by her through some enchantment. For she so charmed and enthralled not only him, but all the rest who had any influence with him, that she conceived the hope of ruling even the Romans. And whenever she used an oath, her strongest phrase in swearing was by her purpose to dispense justice on the Capitol." Now, there are several interesting features of the passage. First of all, we hear that Cleopatra has persuaded Anthony to become a gymnasiarch. This is an office that was specific to Greek cities and cities of the Eastern Mediterranean. The gymnasium was an institution of physical and mental training in Greece. It was unknown in the Latin West. It was not a feature of proper Roman cities, but was a feature of Greek ones. And the gymnasiarch was a municipal office in charge of the running of the gymnasium. So by being a gymnasiarch over the people of Alexandria, he has adopted a totally alien custom to the Roman West. Then there's the scurrilous accusation that Anthony sometimes accompanies Cleopatra on foot along with her eunuch. Her eunuchs, of course, are all slaves. And Anthony is now in the group of slaves following Cleopatra, who's been carried in the litter. So Anthony is here symbolically a slave of Cleopatra. Next is the accusation that Anthony has gone native. He's not dressing in the manner of his native land. He's seen in public in gilded chairs. He's allowing himself to be portrayed as a god, Osiris or Dionysus. This would not be unusual for Eastern despots, but would be unheard of and shocking to public opinion in the West. And the last and most important accusation is that Cleopatra herself has designs on ruling the Roman Empire. She wants to dispense justice on the capital, i.e. she wants to be in control of the city of Rome itself and rule the Romans. Anthony has then become, to all intents and purposes, a foreign enemy of Rome. He has joined sides with a foreign enemy of the Roman state. This is undoubtedly represents some of the essence of Octavian's propaganda against Anthony in these years. The dramatic date of Dio's passage is a bit later, 32 BC, but there's no reason to doubt that this sort of material wasn't floating around several years earlier. It must be said that Anthony played right into Octavian's hands. Specifically, the event known as the Donations of Alexandria in 34 BC warrants some attention. This event was staged in Alexandria in the gymnasium there, a major public building of public congress. And it was sort of a pseudo-triumph staged by Anthony for his not-so-impressive victories over the Parthians. In it, Anthony and Cleopatra were carried into the gymnasium enthroned with their children and with Caesarion, the natural son of Caesar and Cleopatra, who was at this stage 13 years of age. Cleopatra's son, Caesarion, was hailed as King of Kings, and Cleopatra herself was hailed as Queen of Kings. These are ancient titles that have a long heritage in the Near East, but again, ring very foreign and very alien to Western Roman ears. More importantly than that, and the act that gives this whole event its name, the Donations of Alexandria, the whole Eastern Roman Empire was divided up among Anthony and Cleopatra's children and Caesarion. The eastern half of the empire was given, donated to Cleopatra's children. And even more provocatively, Caesarion was acclaimed as the only natural and true son of Caesar, a direct challenge to the foundational claims to legitimacy by Octavian, who had started his whole career and legitimated all his actions as the son of Caesar through adoption in the will of 44 BC. By claiming Caesarion as the true son of Caesar, Anthony and Cleopatra were throwing down the gauntlet to all intents and purposes to Octavian. This event was a major political coup for Octavian. He could now up his propaganda campaign against Anthony, which he did. Following the issue of the donations, the situation in Rome gets somewhat more tense. We mustn't imagine that all of the western provinces are lined up behind Octavian, and Anthony has no support there. Anthony is still the senior Caesarian. He's still the senior partner of the triumvirate, and he must have seemed like, with all the resources of the Eastern Empire at his fingertips, he must have seemed like the person who was favoured, if matters ever were to come to war. Octavian then, now posing himself as the defender of traditional Roman ways, allowed himself to retire into private life when the triumvirate technically lapsed in 33 BC. Anthony didn't. He kept using the term as if nothing had happened right up until his death. again, Octavian can portray himself as the traditionalist. He has an oath of allegiance voted to him, eventually, from Italy and the western provinces, which re-legitimizes his position in 32 BC. He can now claim broad base of popular support for his further actions. Interestingly, he outmaneuvers pro-Anthony consuls in the year 32 BC to really polarize the situation as the war of words heats up in the year 32 and on into the year 31. One of the consuls for the year 32 BC, a man called Sosius, was a supporter of Anthony's and spoke openly against Octavian and also wanted to make some legislative measures against Octavian. We don't have to go into the details, but Octavian blocked him with a tribunician veto. Then he was outside Rome at the time, entered the city with an armed escort, came into the Senate with his armed escort, convened a meeting, said to the senators that he had some documents that proved that all the accusations against him leveled by Sosius and Anthony were incorrect, and the pro-Anthony senators, intimidated by the armed escort above all else, fled eastward. There followed a pattern of defection. All we ever hear about, of course, are defections that came from Anthony to Octavian. We don't hear about defections from Octavian to Anthony, but they must have happened as well. But if so, they've been suppressed in the record. Clearly, however, both sides were now preparing for war. Octavian then upped the ante by reading Anthony's will in the Senate. The will declared that Caesarion was the true heir of Caesar, thus undermining Octavian's claim to legitimacy, and pointed out that Anthony wished to be buried in the east at Cleopatra's side. The evidence then seemed to be clear to most that at this point Anthony was now collaborating with a foreign power to take over the Roman world. This is at least how Octavian portrayed matters. Octavian, with his oath of allegiance voted to him in Italy and the western provinces, could claim a new legitimacy and was absolutely confirmed in his position as the leader of the West against the East. He then managed to carry out another great political coup by having the Senate declare war against Cleopatra. The Roman state did not declare war against Anthony. This put Anthony in the position of having to choose between voluntarily fighting against his homeland, siding with his mistress and lover Cleopatra, or abandoning her, which of course Octavian knew would not happen. Once again, Anthony can be portrayed as in the thrall of a foreign power. The whole war can be portrayed not as a civil war, but as a patriotic war against a foreign enemy. For the rest of 32 BC then, after war was declared, both sides armed heavily, and it looked like this was going to be the biggest conflict yet in the Roman Revolution. Anthony could marshal the enormous wealth of the Ptolemaic dynasty, their huge fleets and armies, along with most of the resources of the Eastern Roman Empire, the richest half of the empire. Octavian could marshal all the resources of the western half of the empire and had enormous popular support there. The two leaders in the summer of 31 BC moved towards each other in the area of Greece. Anthony's armies and fleet moved into the bay at Actium on the Adriatic Sea in western Greece. Octavian had some 30 legions and 600 ships and moved into the region to counter him. Cleopatra and Anthony's fleet were blockaded in the bay at Actium by Octavian's fleet, commanded by Agrippa, always Octavian's chief general, and they tried to break out, initiating a major naval battle on the 2nd of September 31 BC, the Battle of Actium. According to our sources, the fight was hanging in the balance when Cleopatra, out of womanly anxiety and inability to deal with the worries of the battle, so we hear, fled the scene. She fled in her royal ship. The Egyptian wing of Anthony's fleet fled with her, and from then on, the battle went in favor of Octavian and Agrippa. The land forces, which were encamped on the shores, never engaged. It turned out that this one naval battle was the decisive battle in the entire conflict. So it was really an anticlimactic event. It might have been expected that this would have been the biggest of all civil wars. It turned out to be resolved in a single afternoon on the 2nd of September 31 BC, the Battle of Actium. This battle established Octavian unequivocally in control of the entire Roman world. He spent some years away from Rome, busying himself in the east, re-establishing the loyalties of armies and so forth that had been in the control of Antony. He chased, for instance, Antony and Cleopatra back to Egypt. Once Octavian arrived, however, all the Roman troops under Antony defected to Octavian's side. He was clearly the winner in the conflict. As Octavian drew in on Alexandria, Cleopatra committed suicide, we hear, by pressing an ass to her breast, and Antony followed shortly thereafter. Octavian then annexed Egypt as a province of Rome, and his coins, in fact, always declared, at least at this period, declared proudly, Aegypta Capta, Aegypta Capta, Egypt captured for Rome. This brings an end to the history of the last of the Hellenistic kingdoms in the Eastern Mediterranean. The Ptolemaic dynasty ended with the suicide of Cleopatra and the annexation of Egypt as a province of Rome. Caesarion, of course, could not be tolerated. His existence was a major threat to Octavian's position, and he had to be executed. But Octavian spared all but one of the children of Antony and Cleopatra. By virtue of his capture of Egypt, Octavian then controlled the enormous wealth of the Ptolemaic dynasty. This obviated any need for further unpleasantness, perhaps more prescriptions, and he was able to pay off his armies with lots of money to spare. So in 29 BC, he returned to Rome as a hero, a defeater, not just of his rival Antony, but of the foreign power that he had portrayed as being the real power behind Antony, the real driving force behind the whole war, celebrated a triumph over Egypt, and stood now at the head of the Roman world as its sole arbiter. This event, these events, especially the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, are generally taken to be the end of the Roman Revolution. Looking back, however, on the events of the previous century, it's a bit hard to see precisely when the Republic ended. If you were to pick a date, it's extremely difficult to do so. Did the Republic end when Tiberius Gracchus made his proposal for land reform? Did it end when Sulla turned his army in Rome in 88 BC? Did it come to an end, as many Romans believed, with the establishment of the pact between Caesar and Crassus and Pompey in 60 BC? Or was it Caesar's domination that really marked the end of the Roman Republic, or the establishment of the Second Triumvirate? Various dates have been proposed and argued about over the years. But I think it's foolish to try and seek a specific date when the Roman Republic ended. Rather, the whole process of the revolution was a long, historically contingent one. What exactly caused it, how it came about, has also been a source of some discussion among scholars. And the dominant view has been that the Roman Revolution was primarily a product of the circumstance of a city-state government, which is what the Republic was, trying to govern and being incapable of governing what was effectively a world empire in Roman eyes, an empire that controlled the entire Mediterranean basin. In other words, this is essentially a structural argument. The argument is that the government of Rome was extremely small. As we've seen that people with hired gangs of hooligans controlling the area of the Forum could effectively control the passing of legislation that affected tens of thousands of people all across the Mediterranean world, assigning provinces to various commanders, redividing the financial wealth of the state as they saw fit. And this is a product of a city-state government, they say, goes this line of argument, trying to rule a world empire. In addition, the politicians of the city-state government are engaged in essentially domestic squabbles, so typical of small-town politics. But unlike other small town politicians, they have the resources of an empire to bring to bear in their conflicts. And so there's almost a natural escalation of small squabbles, political squabbles within a very narrow and narrowly defined Roman Republic, but drawing on the resources of the empire to seek their resolution. As a result, then, goes this argument, it's essentially a structural process. The Roman Revolution is a product of the circumstance of a city-state government trying to rule a bigger empire. This is, I would say, the dominant view currently, but it doesn't have unanimous support. There are those who point out that it's quite difficult to point out exact incidents when the interaction of the city-state government and the wider empire were truly determinative in the course of the Roman Revolution. Rather, goes one line of argument that I must say I do find very convincing. The nature of the Roman Revolution stemmed from the nature of the Roman Republic itself. In other words, the Republic tore itself apart because of its very nature. The nature of the Republic, goes this line of argument, was not a legislated or constitutionally established form of government, but really a series of precedents, a series of accepted patterns of behaviour with set parameters of what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable. And what happens in the late Republic is that those patterns of behaviour are effectively breached, starting with Tiberius Gracchus trying to force through legislation about which he feels very strongly. Those limits on what one was allowed to do and what one should do in running the state became broken. And once the limits were broken, then the floodgates were opened and it was increasingly a free-for-all with no limits placed upon people's behaviour, especially once the army had become politicised following the reforms of Gaius Marius. Personally, I see the fall of the Roman Republic as being much more complex, I think, than either of these explanations. It is a complex process, as we've seen. For me, it's a perfect illustration of the principle of historical contingency. Precedent built upon precedent cumulatively to produce the final result of bringing the Republic to its knees. Had things happened differently at any stage, maybe the revolution would have petered out, or it might have taken a very different path. Just to take a simple example, in late spring, early summer of 133 BC, Tiberius Gracchus needs money to fund his land commission. Just at that moment, he's been blocked by the Senate, just at that moment word comes that the province of Asia has been created, that the kingdom of Pergamum has been donated to Rome. New revenues will soon be available. And this allows Gracchus, whose proposals may have petered out, whose agitation may have petered out in the face of his inability to actually enact them, this allows him a chance to continue and, in fact, escalates the whole conflict further. Had that not happened when it did, maybe things would have panned out differently. Had Gaius Marius not felt it necessary to enroll large numbers of the Capitacensi, of the headcount in the legions, and provide them with equipment at state expense, and then promise them land at the end of service to ensure their loyalties, maybe the Roman military wouldn't have become so politicized. Maybe its loyalties wouldn't have been directed so firmly at its generals and could have been directed more effectively at the state. Had the Senate behaved in a more resolute fashion, any number of stages throughout the Roman Revolution, things may have gone differently. So in my view, then, the revolution is a highly complex procedure and process and should be analysed in a step-by-step basis rather than looking for any overarching single explanation, such as a structural one or one based on patterns of behaviour. Those forms of analysis, I don't believe, are mistaken. They certainly have a cogency, but I think the process is more complex than that. And had the effect, ultimately, of establishing in Rome the imperial system of the Principate under the Emperor Augustus.
Lecture 32. The New Order of Augustus.
Hello and welcome to the 32nd lecture in the History of Ancient Rome. We have now completed our narrative survey of the fall of the Roman Republic, otherwise known as the Roman Revolution. And the focus of our course, the nature of it, will shift slightly over the forthcoming lectures as we look more at events in a thematic way. It seems rather pointless to simply list a procession of emperors and events in every emperor's reign, since unlike the Roman Revolution and the story of the collapse of the Republic, there's no real terminal point to it. It doesn't really accumulate the way that the narrative for the fall of the Roman Republic does. So I'd like now to shift our attention slightly and look at themes more than at the diachronic series of events. What I intend to do in this lecture and then in the next one is examine the system of government that Augustus established. This system is often called the imperial system. It was known to the Romans as the Principate, and it heralds, usually dated to 31 BC in the Battle of Actium, it heralds a new era in Roman history. In the broad picture of the periodization of Roman history, 31 BC is usually taken as the marking point from the end of the Roman Republic and the beginning of a period that's known as the Empire. This can be slightly confusing, since the word empire also applies to the territorial entity of the Roman state, but the imperial period is that which is seen to stretch from the Battle of Actium, usually taken as the beginning date, through to the collapse of Roman power in the West in the 5th century AD. What I want to do in this lecture is to examine specifically the system of government that Augustus evolved over the course of his very long reign. He was fortunate enough to live until AD 14. So if we count his reign beginning from the Battle of Actium, that's a reign of some 45 years, from 31 BC to AD 14. Although rather sickly as a youth, he got increasingly more healthy and firm in his constitution as his years went on, and was rarely sick again after the 20s BC. He rarely succumbed to illness and lived until AD 14. So I want to look then at the development of the imperial system of government, which was to form the basis for the emperor's power for at least the next 200 or more years in the Roman Empire. I did say that this is an evolutionary procedure and an evolutionary process, and that's worth reiterating, because rather like the Republic in some ways, the system of government that Augustus developed was not really written down. It didn't spring out of his head overnight. He didn't sit down with a group of counselors and work it out and then present it to people. Rather, it was a series of agreements. They're often called constitutional settlements by modern scholars. A series of agreements, accommodations reached between Augustus and the ruling class of Rome that created the Principate and resulted really in Augustus having acquired for himself a package of powers and privileges and honors and titles and offices and priesthoods and so on that placed him unquestionably at the head of the state. The ultimate terminal point for this process is generally marked as being around 2 BC, when Augustus, as he became in 27 BC, as we'll see in a minute, when Augustus became father of his country. This was the title that was given to him in 2 BC and established a relationship between Augustus and the Roman state, analogous to that between a head of a household and everyone living in that house. As Augustus, as I'm going to refer to him from here on in, as Augustus developed this system of government, he really had three major concerns that he wanted to deal with. His primary concern was to maintain the peace. He could not allow further civil wars to break out. For that reason, control over the army was to be one of his chief concerns. Secondly, he wanted to bring some form of stability to the Roman state. He wanted to ensure that the governance of the state was not subject to the sort of rampant disorder that had been a mark of the late Roman Republic. And thirdly, and by no means least in importance, is his concern to avoid the fate of his adopted father, Caesar the dictator. What had happened to Caesar must have loomed large in Augustus's mind throughout his life. Caesar had been, despite his immense popularity, his huge military power, he'd nonetheless been cut down by only a handful of aristocrats. It was imperative for Augustus, whatever he was to do in reforming the state, it must be done in such a way as to avoid the fate of his adopted father, Caesar the dictator. When exactly he began thinking about reformulating his position is not quite clear. Following the Battle of Actium from 31 through 27, Octavian, as he was then, maintained his consulship on an annual basis. Remember that in 32 BC he had this oath of loyalty taken to him personally by Italy and the western provinces. This seems to have been his fundamental claim to power, fundamental claim especially to legitimacy, but he held a consulship every year as a way of maintaining his position, but that was only a temporary arrangement. Unlike Caesar, he must have been thinking about what he was going to do. How was he going to establish his position in such a way as not to appear to be overly autocratic? The big break comes in 27 BC and then again in 23 BC with two accommodations, two settlements that are known as the first and second constitutional settlements respectively. But we'll see as well that there are also some supplementary ancillary developments in the intervening and subsequent years that helped to establish Augustus's position in the state. He's announced in 28 BC that he was rescinding all of his triumviral edicts and bills. In a way, he was wiping the slate clean, saying that that period is over and erasing it from the record of his official career. And one can see why. It's not difficult to see why he had behaved in a way that was less than constitutional, less than traditional. And remember, he had recast himself in the latter part of the 30s BC as the defender of tradition and the defender of traditional Roman ways. This was to be, in fact, one of the keys to his whole system of the Principate as he evolved it in the subsequent decades. Then, on the 13th of January 27 BC, a very carefully staged piece of political theatre took place. Augustus, or Octavian as he then was, entered the Senate and gave a lengthy speech on the burdens of office, the extent of the empire, and how difficult it was to rule it, how he had no desire to dominate over anyone, and how, as a result, he was relinquishing all of his authority and retiring to private life. The senators were hushed, shocked. Some of them, of course, were in the know as to what to do. Shouts were heard. No, you can't do that. What will we do without you? You're so indispensable to the running of the state. Please. Please, you can't abandon us like this. Augustus modestly demurred. Sorry, it seems like it's all too much. Well, please, we have some suggestions. Oh, well, what might they be? And then he accepted a package of privileges and powers that mark the so-called first constitutional settlement. It's important to appreciate immediately, however, before we look at what those powers were, that immediately the situation with regard to Augustus and that with regard to Caesar are quite different. Augustus is reluctantly accepting the position of, I suppose, curator of the state, one who's watching over the affairs of the Roman Res Publica, and that this has been foisted on him against his will and his inclination, which is made clear through his lengthy speech that he just wants to retire, and that immediately a very different situation pertains than that in which Caesar just blandly accepted whatever powers were voted his way, and if we can believe our sources, was seeking the ultimate power of kingship. Well, the various powers can be broken down to three major aspects of this particular settlement. First of all, Octavian, as he then was renamed. He became Imperator Caesar Augustus, and he's known from this point on as Augustus. Imperator, which was a word meaning a general, became a name. He was known as General in terms of that being his personal name. Caesar, of course, his ancestral name from Julius Caesar. And Augustus, a word laden with symbolic value, one who is august, blessed, sacred, special, authoritative, influential. All of those ideas worked into just his name. Then he accepted a special province. In fact, it was an enormous province that comprised all the regions of the empire where legions were stationed. He was given this special command. Again, there was precedent for this. We had seen it going back to the time of Pompey, who accepted a special major proconsular command over the entire Mediterranean Sea to deal with pirates, and then over the eastern half of the empire. So there was a precedent for this as well. So it didn't seem necessarily that it was particularly revolutionary or autocratic. This was something that people would have been used to at this period. This enormous province, as I say, extended over all those areas of the empire where legions were stationed, except one, Africa. He was to exercise, rather like Pompey in 55 BC over Spain, he was to exercise his authority over these regions through representatives, legates, who were appointed as ambassadors of his imperium over the regions of the empire that he controlled. This was given to him for a 5-year period. Again, there's an element of it being terminal. It's not a permanent lifetime situation. It's a temporary arrangement. Augustus is sort of temporarily in control of this enormous section of the empire. The rest of the empire, the other provinces, all of them unarmed except for Africa, remained in the control of the Senate, who continued to appoint proconsuls and so forth to notably unarmed provinces. So he had then proconsular imperium, the power of a governor represented by his legates on the ground over all of Rome's legions. The legates were, of course, personally appointed by Augustus himself from among the people he trusted most. This gave Augustus firm control over the army, and that was the first requirement of his settlement of the state. It was essential that the loyalties of the army not be divided. We see other measures were taken in due course to ensure that situation. But proconsular imperium was effective, as was the traditional situation, was effective only outside of Rome and was restricted to the areas of the empire where Augustus's imperium was said to apply. Within Rome and within Italy, he continued to hold the consulship every year as a way of controlling administrative matters, legislative matters. His proconsular power, proconsular imperium did not give him the right to introduce legislation to the people or suggest bills to the Senate or whatever, or convene the Senate. That he gained through the consulship. After a period of some years in 23 BC, a refinement to this basic settlement was deemed necessary. This second settlement in 23 BC is called the Second Constitutional Settlement by modern scholars. In this year, Augustus fell ill. He fell gravely ill. This was his last major illness until his terminal one in AD 14. And it was perhaps in the wake of this illness, or some suggest in the wake of a very shadowy conspiracy against his life, which took place in this year, that the second settlement came to be initiated. By means of the second settlement, Augustus's proconsular imperium, his power outside of Rome, was upgraded to be made maius, greater. This gave him greater imperium, greater gubernatorial authority than any governor anywhere in the empire, be it in his own provinces or in the Senate's provinces. Within Italy, Augustus was able to relinquish the consulship and traded it for a unique power. But the second real cornerstone of the emperor's power, the first being the proconsular power over the armies. The second power that was introduced in 23 BC was the tribunician power, the tribunicia potestas. This gave Augustus the power of a tribune of the plebs. He was not actually a tribune of the plebs. He just had the powers and rights of a tribune of the plebs. Therefore, he could convene the Senate, propose legislation, and so on and so forth. He was also sacrosanct, although that may have taken place as early as 36 BC. But he enjoyed all these rights that tribunes of the plebs had traditionally enjoyed, without actually being a tribune of the plebs. This is a rather different situation, rather unique, slightly different from what had gone on in the Republic, but But nonetheless, it was familiar looking. It wasn't absolutely revolutionary that this should be the case. Just like his proconsular power, the grant of tribunician power was only temporary, 5, possibly 10 years in duration. 5 years initially. So, by the situation, by the end of 23 BC, when Augustus had recovered from his illness and this conspiracy against his life had been suppressed, although I must say, in relation to that conspiracy, it does seem that it took place later in the year. It may have been a reaction to the settlement of 23 BC rather than a stimulus for it. But the evidence about that conspiracy is very uncertain and very unclear to us. But by the end of this year, then, Augustus's two major powers were now firmly in place. He was a proconsul with maius imperium, greater power than any other governor on the ground. Outside of Rome and Italy, and within Rome, he was a holder of tribunicia potestas, of tribunician power that allowed him to control the administration of the state, introduce legislation and veto legislation and summon the Senate and so on. Further refinements took place. After these years, he was, of course, made a member of all the priestly colleges in Rome. Once Lepidus died in 12 BC, he automatically, well, he was given the chief priesthood. He became Pontifex Maximus of Rome. He also instituted a system whereby the army, which was reformed in a way that I'll examine at the beginning of the next lecture, reformed into the world's first professional standing voluntary military force, and stationed in locations around the empire, all members of the army took a personal oath of loyalty to Augustus himself, and his image was carried around with every legion and kept in a very special place in the legionary camps. So the Roman army became effectively a private army of Augustus. He had the imperium to command it, but they also had taken a sacred oath of loyalty to his person. He was also declared exempt from certain taxes, and a variety of other honours and privileges were all granted to him. He could address the Senate first before anyone else, and so on and so forth. I don't go into the details of the various packages of privileges that were given to him, in addition to his two basic and most important powers of proconsular imperium over the provinces and tribunician power in Rome. All of this culminated with the grant in 2 BC of the honorific title Father of his Country, Pater Patriae, which he was very proud of, and in many ways established for Augustus and expressed his control over the Roman Empire. He was now like a father to the nation, a man who, like a father, is concerned for its welfare, but is entrusted with all the important decisions and the management of the state. It was, for him, a perfect expression of the position that he had attained. Several characteristics of the system, as they evolved over these decades, warrant attention. First of all, and it must be stressed again, all of Augustus's powers, honours, titles, privileges, his name, all of them were granted officially to Augustus voluntarily by the Senate and people of Rome. He had not extorted or extracted any of them. In fact, he had relinquished all his authority and claims over the state and had them handed back to him. Through the twin powers of Imperium Maius in the provinces and tribunician power in Italy and Rome, Augustus had access and an avenue to all aspects of the administration of the empire in all its regions, domestic and foreign. Throughout, and this is a cardinal feature of the system as it was evolved by Augustus, the traditional republican forms and titles are maintained. Augustus gets Imperium Maius, but others before him had had that. The grants of both tribunician power and his proconsular imperium are temporary. They're in batches of 5 years. The fact that no one ever talks about thinking about not renewing them is beside the point. Of course, every time they come up for renewal, they're automatically renewed and eventually extended to 10-year grants because it got tedious to do it every 5. But the point is that the traditional republican forms are maintained. The res publica, the recognizable organs of public life as they had existed in Rome for centuries, continue to exist. The Senate still meets. Consuls are still elected. praetors are still elected, popular votes are taken, and so on and so forth. And Augustus's position is more like someone who's grafted on top of the